Good morning. Well, Brexit's back, and with a bang. Remember the relief last October when a withdrawal agreement was finally reached and then signed into law in January? Well, scratch that. Now the UK government wants to introduce new legislation to effectively break that treaty and in doing so, break international law. The Internal Market Bill, for that is its name, will allow the UK government to unilaterally interpret the Northern Ireland Protocol's rules on state aid and customs declarations. Back on Monday, when this was just a rumour, Peter Foster of the Financial Times, who broke the story, spoke to Claire Byrne.
A deal is a deal, though, and I see the Latin phrase bandied around on Twitter last night and this morning, pacta sunt servanda, agreements must be kept. What does this say about Britain's word?
Well, that's clearly a problem with this, isn't it? Is that, you know, if you want to, if this is a gambit to get a last minute deal or a gambit to get the Northern Ireland Protocol rewritten in a way that's more palatable to the British government, the danger is that, you know, if I'm negotiating an 11th hour deal with you in October, November, and you've just spent 2 months blowing holes in the previous agreement that you'd negotiated, it's quite difficult to do that in good faith.
And Claire asked a deceptively simple question.
What is it that the UK wants?
What does the UK mean? What does the government mean? You know, what does Boris Johnson want? What does Lord Frost want? What does
Michael Gove want? We could be here for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I think they probably do want a deal, but they don't want it at any cost.
Oh, so many questions. And that line of jaw-dropping incredulity and, frankly, bafflement was the tone to much of the week. Later that day, Mary Wilson on Drive Time spoke to Rona McCrae, Professor of Constitutional and European Law at University College London.
But isn't it always worth asking the why? Why would Britain be pursuing this piece of legislation? Why would they do that when they signed off on an agreement and on a treaty, an internationally binding treaty, late last year?
I think it might be a case of short-termism in that the current negotiations are at an impasse and there's hardly any time left. And they've become stuck on the issue of state aid, and they've really reached the EU will not give in on that issue, and the UK looks like it won't give in. So they want to use the Northern Ireland issue to see if it can pile pressure on the EU to make a concession at this stage. But the EU is never going to give it to allow Britain to walk away from something it signed up to explicitly. The problem from Ireland's point of view is that a lot of the EU's leverage over is gone, because the EU has its greatest source of leverage in these talks, in the whole process, has been the threat of cutting Britain off from the single market. But it seems that no matter what happens now, Britain is hell-bent on having a very minimal deal that involves very significant loss of access to the single market. So the EU can no longer threaten to cut them off from the single market, because they're going to be cut off to a large degree anyway. And with the withdrawal agreement, Northern Ireland Protocol, if there is a dispute on that and we end up relying on the procedures of the protocol, it's pretty limited. All the protocol says is that we could have arbitration of a dispute, and then the arbitration panel can put a financial penalty on the UK or can allow the EU not to fulfil its obligations under the withdrawal agreement. So but neither of those things will stop a hard border from coming into place.
So was it a case of sovereignty over economics?
Britain, whatever happens, is headed for a really disruptive Brexit that's going to happen in the middle of winter, in the middle of the COVID crisis. If they worried about economics, they wouldn't have gone for the very minimal deal that they're going for. Because even if we get a deal, even if all this gets sorted out, the only deal we can get with this amount of time remaining and with the policy preferences of the British government is a really limited one that involves big economic disruption for Ireland and British-Irish trade.
Well, Sinn Féin's Mary Lou MacDonald was on the same programme, and she was employing an approach best described as 800 years and counting.
I'm not outraged at all. In fact, if I'm to be perfectly blunt with you, I'm not surprised by these leaks either. I think the Tory governments historically, and this one in particular, have demonstrated their capacity to saber-rattle and to make empty and idle threats and others that they might stand by. So I'm not a bit surprised. I'm not surprised either at the concept of a British government dishonouring and walking away from agreements that they've entered into. I could cite you chapter and verse on that particular subject, Mary. You won't be surprised to hear.
Now, there are two possibilities here. Prime Minister Boris Johnson knows exactly what he's doing, the sabre-rattling brinkmanship tactic, or he's pushing for a no deal, in which case it's Bollinger for Boris and the devil take the hindmost. But what about the EU? Well, on Tuesday's Morning Ireland, Audrey Carvel spoke to Philippe Lambert, MEP and member of the Brexit Steering Committee. And for him, a deal is a deal.
Maybe Mr. Johnson should learn reading English, because if I'm not mistaken, that treaty has been written in English, which is his native tongue. So probably should have taken time to read it before signing it. I mean, he was and he is the elected Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, and that comes with responsibilities. And the first of it is knowing what you do.
Oh, I don't think he'll need a translator to understand the tone anyway. But if the UK were employing a kind of, yeah, let's just see how far we can push it, might the EU concede just for the quiet life? Like hell they will.
So just finally, Mr. Lamberts, are you saying very clearly this morning that the European Parliament, the Brexit Steering Committee, will not tolerate any changes to the withdrawal agreement agreed last year?
Absolutely. I mean, we have negotiated that withdrawal agreement for more than a year under two prime ministers. Boris Johnson wanted to renegotiate it. We did so because the treaty was not sealed yet. But once it has been sealed, signed by the British Prime Minister and ratified both by the British Parliament and the European Parliament, it's a done deal. And its legal obligations engage the United Kingdom regardless of the kind of future relationship we are going to have. I mean, this treaty is not contingent on any future relationship deal. And that should be understood by the hard Brexiteers. I know they hate it, because indeed the conditions that have been put in that treaty give a special treatment to Northern Ireland, which makes it jurisdictionally somewhat different from the rest of the UK. But that was the price of the deal.
MEP Philippe Lambert on Tuesday's Morning Ireland. Now, the UK admits that they are knowingly breaking international law, but in a, and I quote, very specific and limited way. Nothing to see here. That print is fierce small. But not so specific and limited, it seems, to stop their most senior lawyer, Sir Jonathan Jones, resigning on Tuesday afternoon. Well, former Irish ambassador to the UK and the EU, Bobby McDonough, spoke to Mary Wilson that evening, and for a former diplomat, he wasn't being in the least bit diplomatic.
Now, what's happened here is of massive significance. The UK government is sending two contradictory messages. It's saying in the House of Commons, this is just a small breach of international law, and I'll come back to that. But it's clearly briefing the tabloids that this is a significant rewriting of the whole withdrawal agreement. And the answer to that conundrum lies in the resignation of the most senior legal official in the British system. I mean, it's quite clear that Jonathan Jones, who resigned this afternoon, saw it as an outrageous breach of the law and a principle that an international treaty would be reneged on in this way. So, look, come back to the question of whether it's a big or a small breach of international law. The criminals don't get away with it if they say, I robbed a small bank, not a large bank, or I only stole a limited amount of money. You know, it is incredible that a country that has for some time been associated with democracy and in calling on China to respect the rule of law, that it should behave in this way. It's I'm afraid, a sign of some of the deeper things that are happening in the UK, and that's why it's important, with the Tories having a majority, the only way to avoid more of this happening is if some of the Tories develop a spine as well as their bemusement.
So just how should EU negotiator Michel Barnier respond to Boris throwing his toys out of the pram?
I think he will behave like a parent does with a child who's throwing a tantrum. I mean, all parents know that when a child is doing something totally irrational, you first of all remain calm, but secondly, you're firm with the child about unacceptable behaviour. And I must say, you know, Barnier's reaction so far since this was announced is very low-key. He's remaining calm, but I think he's going to make it absolutely clear on behalf of the whole European Union that this behaviour is unacceptable. I can't guess at this stage precisely how he will manage it tactically. It would be entirely justifiable to walk away from the negotiations, but the EU is the only adult in this negotiation, and it's going to try to find a way to get a deal, but it's also going to have to address this issue of principle. I mean, how can you agree a new deal if your partner just says, well, we're not going to implement the last one? So it's a very tricky situation, but I think he'll handle it very professionally.
The naughty step for Boris, that was Bobby McDonough on Drive Time on Wednesday. Tánaiste the Leo Varadkar was on Morning Ireland, and Brian Dobson went for the soft underbelly.
You sat across the table from Mr. Johnson. You trusted him, presumably, to deliver on the protocol. Were you naive?
No. That's an agreement which we made, an agreement which was subsequently ratified by the House of Commons, the House of Lords, and also the European Parliament. I think, though, going back to a year ago, certainly the strategy and behaviour of the British government was one of brinkmanship, was one of threatening to crash out. You know, if we don't get to an agreement, we might go kamikaze on you, that sort of thing. I kind of hope this is just another instalment of this, that the most benign assessment I can give you is that this is brinkmanship, that this is saber rattling. If we don't get an FTA, this is what we'll do. So that's my benign interpretation of it, and perhaps this is just part of the negotiation process in order to come to a free trade agreement with the EU, but I don't think we can assume it's that.
Yeah, you said after those talks in October that you were absolutely convinced that the United Kingdom wanted a deal. Are you still absolutely convinced?
I think they want a deal, but of course they will want a deal on the best terms they can get.
Kamikaze, eh? That was Taoiseach the Leo Varadkar, and that night the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, dialed across the water to Prime Minister Johnson. Awkward. The next day, Carol Coleman on Morning Ireland put this to the Taoiseach.
You set out your concerns in forthright terms to Boris Johnson. What did you say to him?
Well, I made it very clear to him in no uncertain terms or outright opposition to the moves that he and his government took yesterday, the unilateral nature of the British government's decision to break an international treaty or to signal its intention through the publication of this bill of breaching an international treaty and its obligations under the Northern Ireland Protocol. I pointed out very strongly to him that this was very unsettling for Northern Ireland, that it was dragging Northern Ireland back into the centre stage, that it was bad for Northern Ireland politics and would be divisive. But more fundamentally, I made a point to him that we all have obligations as political leaders to protect our peoples from the worst effect of a no deal, and that this intervention was very, very serious and has raised a fundamental issue of trust between the European Union negotiators and the United Kingdom and ourselves, that when we enter into an agreement, solemnly engaged in hard-working negotiations and so on, you sign off, you go through your own parliament and your own parliament approves this, and then you decide to undermine that international agreement, that has implications for the conduct of negotiations into the future.
But it seems trust would be the least of Boris Johnson's concerns. But maybe it should be. Because if they're looking to the US to do business, it won't wash there. Here's US Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi.
This news comes to us practically in the middle of the night that the UK had decided to undermine the Good Friday Accords. What were they thinking? Whatever it is, I hope they're not thinking of a UK-US bilateral trade agreement to make up for what they might lose.
On Thursday afternoon, all sides came to the table, and the latest is yet another deadline. The EU have given the UK to the end of the month to change the bill or risk jeopardising trade negotiations entirely. And they rejected UK claims that these changes were there to protect the Good Friday Agreement. Tony Blair's former Chief of Staff, Jonathan Powell, spoke to Mary Wilson on Thursday's Drive Time.
But if it's so clear to you and others we've spoken to as well that this piece of legislation is not about protecting the Good Friday Agreement, what do you believe it is about?
I fear what it is politics. The government has been suffering. It's been going down in the polls because of the way they've mishandled coronavirus. They've made a real mess of it here in the UK. And for them, getting back to the battle on Brexit and polarising things is their best bet. They've got a base of about 30% of the voters and about 10% of Brexiteers on top of that. If they can galvanise the Brexiteers by reopening this issue and making it look like the EU is bullying them, making it difficult, then they hope they can regain their popularity and change the issue, change the subject from the issue of coronavirus.
A cynicism that would make you shiver, surely not. That was Jonathan Powell on Drive Time. But breathe out. We're done with Brexit. For now, anyway. Back in a bit. Welcome back. This weekend marks 6 months since COVID-19 really hit our country. And when Tommy Tiernan spoke to Ray Darcy yesterday, he let slip that he did not have a good lockdown.
So how bad did it get, or you know, what effect did it have on you?
After drama, I tell you how bad it got me. That's what you're after. That's a fishy little question, isn't it? Say something awful. Were you walking under the nip all day drinking whiskey, shouting at the kids? How'd you know that? I was. I was the worst homeschool teacher ever. Daddy, put on some clothes. I think back then, I think we just started getting on each other's nerves.
Yeah.
You know, I even started playing Fortnite. That's...
It's Roblox now, Tommy. You're so behind.
That's how bad it got. I was buying skins and...
avatars and...
So,
I'm not going to get anything serious out of you.
I don't know. I think we started getting on each other's nerves.
Yeah.
And we spent about a month of realising it's just the five of us in the house. How do we kind of, you know, the thing of eating lunch together and eating dinner together and daddy making dinner. The kids got sick of that one fairly quick. I don't know what happened. I think the lifting of restrictions kind of eased that. Once the kids were able to meet their pals, you know.
That was a big thing.
And that kind of took some of the tension out of the house.
But Tommy talked about how this enforced retreat from the world had affected him.
The energy to do gigs, that kind of confidence, it's not in my back pocket anymore.
Right.
You know, so... But that's... a rhythm thing, that's a habitual thing that just takes time to get back into the groove of everything. So this is a great retreat. I think that's what we're experiencing now. It was a huge big retreat back into ourselves, into our houses.
And what did you learn about yourself?
That I'm a bit of a sand rabbit. What did I learn about myself? That I need stimulation. I don't know. I think I learned about myself that being at home all the time doesn't suit me.
Yeah.
And that I need the stimulation of crowds. I need adrenaline in my body. I need the excitement of change. And if I don't get that, I turn into a dog that starts barking at himself and those closest to him. And that's that's the difficulty. And that's a real thing. And that's part of the struggle that everybody's having is that this thing doesn't suit us. You know, this way of life is doesn't suit us.
Tommy Turnham with Ray yesterday, and he's not wrong there. Now, while rumours swirl about more possible lockdowns amid rising numbers of COVID-19, this week saw the news that September 21st would see pubs reopening. All going well, of course. Maybe don't buy that keg just yet. But whatever your view on this, the opening of pubs led to something of a contradiction in the minds of Liveline callers when it came to pregnancy and birth. Why, if you can get a pint in the pub, can both prospective parents not be together for all stages of birth? As the rules stand, fathers are only allowed in for the final stages of labour, and for scan appointments, however critical, not at all. On Tuesday, Alan phoned Joe, and he was frustrated.
Our situation is myself and my wife, she's 36 weeks pregnant, bags packed, ready to go. Been a long enough pregnancy. I appreciate I haven't been able to attend any scans or appointments, but I just can't fathom the logic that the hospitals are using. Once I'm in a building for more than 15 minutes, how much more of a COVID risk do I pose to anybody? If I turn up and I get my temperature taken and I'm wearing my PPE and I'm literally sitting at my wife's side supporting her through what is this fairly, as I said, life-changing event, I don't see how I can pose any more of a risk than what would be out there. And I think it is horrendous.
Now, the maternity hospitals say that these restrictions help keep mothers, babies and staff safe and minimise the risk of the virus spreading. But the following day, women started to phone into Joe to tell of their experience of being on their own at a time when they most needed support. This is Samantha's story.
We found out we were pregnant, so after previous miscarriages, we went up to the early pregnancy unit, and at this stage, there's no parents allowed in. You're told you're going in on your own. So we went to it. That's daunting enough. I remember sitting in the unit just texting my husband, just saying, this is horrible, like, I wish you could be here. I feel so alone, you know. So thankfully, everything was fine on that scan. Next, we get the next date for the next scan, which is the 12-week scan. So like that, back up to the hospital on my own. He's doing laps in the car. waiting for the good news to come out, but sadly there isn't any good news. So I'm sitting there and I'm just alone texting again, saying this is terrible, they're taking all day. I wish you were here. I can't do this on my own. Anyway, go into the room. It was just like the longest walk to the corridor, to that room, in on the bed, and it's just myself and the sonographer, and unfortunately she delivers the news. Sadly, there's no heartbeat there, so at that stage, you're kind of like, I just felt like falling apart, collapsing on the floor. The sonographer is there, and she's, I'm sorry, I can't even hug you, you know, she's tearing up, I'm tearing up, everybody's kind of all upset. They move you to a different room, and then you can then ring your husband, because it was the Friday, to make a plan as to what happens next. So I'm sitting in the room on my own while he struggles to find parking. It's cruel. I can't describe the words in words how I felt that day. And then the Saturday, back into the hospital for testing for this lovely COVID. And back in on Monday for the operation, alone, go in alone, wake up alone. It's as if pregnant women don't need their partners. Yeah. They're expected to do it all on their own. It's not a time to be alone, especially when it's not always good news.
Yeah.
Samantha with Joe on Wednesday, and by Thursday, more callers, mostly women, had phoned in to tell of their loneliness and distress at being without their partners when they were feeling at their most vulnerable. Sharon was the opening call.
It was around 12:30 this day last week, and I noticed that I had started to bleed. Mm-hmm. So my doctor had told me that if there was any bleeding whatsoever, to go to the hospital straight away.
Okay.
So I had to wait for my partner to come home from work because I wasn't able to drive. The pain had started as well. So I knew that with the restrictions that partners weren't allowed in for scans, but we both thought that when it was an emergency that he would have been allowed in. But unfortunately, even though I explained to the nurse at the door what was happening, there was no way he was allowed to come in.
You said, I need to go to the maternity unit ASAP. I'm bleeding at the moment, unfortunately. And I presume you were obviously in great distress. It was obvious that you were deeply, deeply upset. Was Pat there, your partner, as we're calling him, was he there beside you, Sharon?
Yeah, he was. He was at the door with me as they took, you know, my temperature for COVID to allow us into the hospital. And there was just no way he was coming in. He was allowed to come in.
So he had to stay outside?
He had to stay outside. When I went into the waiting room, was full of heavily pregnant women waiting to have their babies. Yeah. And also women waiting for their scans. There was just absolutely no way I could sit in the room with those women. Sitting in reception was nearly just as bad. I could actually see my partner outside the door from where I was sitting. I was sitting there bleeding and in pain, and I think it was close to an hour and a half before he was even seen.
Sharon with Joe. And then Peter phoned in.
My wife is expecting tomorrow week, the 17th, she's going in for the section. We lost the baby. She had a miscarriage 3 years ago, and any topic. And she was told that all the time since the pregnancy, since the COVID, that I won't be allowed in. I'll be allowed in just when she's going into theatre, and when she has the baby, and then that'll be it. And she'll be kept in the hospital for approximately 7 days after the section, and I won't be allowed in till I have to come in and collect her on the 7th day. And she's just very, very nervous. Like, every time I go for a scan, every time I go to the doctor, she's just thinking the worst. And she was in my arms the other night, and she was so worried, like, saying that she's not going to get through. She's so scared to go into theatre again. And it's just, and just to think that she's going to be by herself.
Yeah.
Just wrong, like.
Peter with Joe. And when Kate phoned in, she talked about miscarrying in July after becoming pregnant via IVF.
When I was miscarrying, I actually ended up going to the emergency room because the bleeding was so heavy and I was so concerned. And again, that was alone. And I had another follow-up scan in the early pregnancy assessment unit after my miscarriage, and that was alone. So in total, I had 5 appointments alone throughout my miscarriage. For men, and especially men who are going through IVF with their wives, you're so far removed from the process already with a pregnancy, and even with a normal pregnancy, it's the same.
Yeah.
But you're so far removed from the process that you're not processing. I can imagine that men aren't processing what's happening. And for them not to be able to process the miscarriage as well, or not to be there and be able to support their partners through these situations, is just heartbreaking.
And finally, Sinead phoned in. She had miscarried twice during lockdown, in May and then just a fortnight ago.
Well, yeah, we found out we were pregnant at the beginning of May. Never in a million years thought that anything would go wrong, but sadly it started to at kind of 5.5 weeks. Started bleeding at home, so I had to ring Holles Street and went in by myself, drove myself in, you know, just soul-destroying stuff. So to be told, they couldn't really, it was very early on, so they didn't really know what was going on. So the rest of that week was kind of in and out myself with getting blood taken, having scans. And then the following week, they confirmed that I was having a miscarriage, that the baby had no heartbeat. So.
And was your husband allowed?
No. Okay. No, I was on my own for all of them. The only time he drove me in was when I had the D&C procedure then, 2 weeks after that. So all the scans and the blood, all of that was me driving myself into to Holles Street. And the day that I found out actually that there was no heartbeat, I got as far as the little prayer room in Holles Street and just collapsed in a heap. And just, yeah, it's very difficult. It's a time when, you know, you shouldn't have to be strong, but you're kind of forced to be because you're alone. So, and you can't fault the staff. I mean, they almost have an extra job to do with all of the emotions and everything that they have to deal with because the partners aren't there to support. And the staff have just been incredible, but it's just, it's very wrong. So we then found out not long after that I was pregnant again, which was incredible. We were thrilled, didn't think it would happen so quickly. And everything was going beautifully. Got past the whole 5.5 week mark and was very excited and started to kind of relax. And decided to go for a private scan just to make sure that everything was okay. And I'd actually emailed ahead and I said, look, you know, would there be any chance that my husband could come in with me? I've just suffered a loss very recently and I'm just a bit nervous, and would there be any way? And they just said, unfortunately not, that they, you know, the directors weren't willing to kind of ease off on any of the restrictions and procedures they had in place just yet. And this was 3 weeks ago.
Nice.
So I went in very positive and hopeful, but unfortunately they couldn't actually find the pregnancy this time, so it had just implanted in one of my tubes instead of where it should have been.
Yeah.
So when I left then, obviously my husband was waiting outside the door, and I walked as far as the stairwell and just collapsed into a bit of a mess. I was absolutely devastated. So again, it was back into Holles Street that week for more scans and more bloods, and all by myself, sitting in waiting room B in Holles Street. But yeah, I was in then for 3 days before they decided to operate them. So that was just a couple of weeks ago.
And for Sinead, going for lunch with her husband brought it home to her just how distressing the whole experience had been, and in her eyes, illogical.
And you make the point, Sinead, myself and my husband were able to go out to a restaurant last week.
So yeah, last Thursday we went out for a bite to eat for lunch just to get out the house. Yeah. And, you know, we walked in and we sat down, and obviously you've got no mask on because you're eating your lunch. We were there for maybe 45 minutes, 50 minutes. And I just remember just saying to him, like, it's so wrong that we can sit here and enjoy this yummy lunch, and yet I had to be on my own for all of those scans and appointments. Like, it's just, I feel like the priorities just maybe need to shift a little.
Sinead, one of the many women and men who phoned into Liveline this week. Back after this. Welcome back. It's time for something nice, but also slightly nasty. Nellie Olson was, as Ryan Tuberty told us, the first and ultimate mean girl. The ringlets, the spite, the picking on her brother, all up against the sugary sweetness that was Laura Ingalls Wilder on the classic television series Little House on the Prairie. Well, little Nellie is all grown up and has written a book.
Prairie Bitch, How I Survived Nellie Olson and Learned to Love Being Hated.
Take that, Walnut Grove. And actor Alison Arngrim started the interview by telling Ryan about going with her father to the audition for the part and realising that Nellie Olson was, well, this is how she put it.
This girl's
well, she's a total bitch. And he starts laughing hysterically. I read it for him. He starts laughing. He says, don't change a thing. Mm. Don't touch it. Don't do anything. Don't breathe. Don't even look at it again. You read it exactly like that. And I went, and there was Michael Landon and Kent McRae and Ed Friendly, the original producers. And I started reading, and it was that first episode where I talk in the school about how much everything in my house cost. It's a class essay, and it's my home is the best home in all of Walnut Grove. They were in a certain, they couldn't stop laughing. And they said, can you do it again, please? And I said, oh, yes, did you want me to change something? He said, no, just do the thing about the house again. And I read it, and they laughed hysterically again. By the time I got home, less than half an hour, they had already called my agent and made the deal, and my wardrobe fitting was next week. I was hired on the spot. It was something, Michael was very big on don't act, just come in and do it very realistically.
Yeah.
And whatever I did, I hit a nerve.
And what, pray tell, of the legacy of playing such a meanie?
Now as an adult, when you say to people, yeah, that was me, I was Nellie Austin.
I do get this look of sort of wide-eyed horror, even from grown people. During the show, I mean, I had someone throw a cup of orange soda at my head during a Christmas parade. I had children kick me. I had people throw things, yell, scream, carry on. But just a couple of years ago, I was at an autograph show. And this is, you know, current time. And a woman, a grown person in her late 40s, came in. And she didn't say hello or good morning or anything. She just came up, looked incredibly angry, and just smoke coming out of her ears, and looked at me and said, I forgive you, and walked out.
And let's not forget about the hair.
Can you give me a sense of the follicle pain you had to suffer in order to succeed?
Absolute pure torture, it's true. The way they tried curling my hair when it started, my hair does not take a curl, it's very straight. And they tried curling my hair, which meant I was 12 years old and sleeping in curlers and coming in at 4 in the morning. It's a disaster. And then they said, all right, we're having a wig made. And so they had a custom-made wig, very beautiful, very expensive. But this meant a giant metal comb that dug into my scalp and dozens of pins to hold it on. Well, because it had to stay on during mud fights and going down hills in wheelchairs and things. So it was practically nailed to my head.
Mm.
It was excruciatingly uncomfortable, and I had to wear it for 9 hours a day.
Well, no wonder you were a bitch.
Yes, exactly. That's what's so mean. It was that, if you had that thing on your head, you'd be terrible, too.
Wouldn't you? You'd be shooting out at everyone going, God damn you all.
Ooh, that does sound painful. But there was more to Alison Arngrim than just playing mean girls with curls. She had suffered sexual abuse and wanted to highlight her work on this issue, and in particular, the double standard involved if the abuser was known to the child.
When I was very young, I was abused. I was physically and sexually abused. I was a victim of sexual abuse as a child. And I did, of course, you don't tell anyone, you know, because they tell you no one will believe you. They tell you they'll kill you. They tell you you'll get in trouble. So, of course, you don't think you're six. You don't really think clearly that, of course not, he'll get in trouble. What am I doing? You think like a six-year-old. So, of course, you wind up not telling anyone. It's awful. And this went on for a couple of years. And so I didn't tell anyone. So by the time I had the show, it had stopped. But I still had this secret I didn't dare tell anyone, and this absolutely contributed to my being shy and awkward and being bullied. And I eventually only had therapy, but I wound up going public. And I really went public because of a marvelous group, the charity that I'm on the board of, Protect.org. We wound up going into Sacramento, the capital of California, and, well, we've done several states now, and changing laws to benefit and better protect victims of sexual abuse.
You make an excellent point in this book, which is there are layers of abuse. It's all horrible, but there are layers within the horror.
Yep.
And by that I mean, if it's a family member, you know, as you say, and I'm quoting you, you say, when people find out about sexual abuse of a child, and if it's a stranger, people grab their rifle and hop into a pickup. But when it's a family member, they don't know what to do. They put down the rifle and think, we've got to get them help.
Yeah, yeah. They're not. Their sympathy is initially with the child. And then they say, oh, well, it's someone you know who abused them. It's your cousin, your brother. Oh, well, you know, maybe. It's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
5 minutes ago, you were ready to call the cops.
Yes.
And
what happens there?
It's awful. And that's what happens. That's why these people do it. These people who are predators, who seek out children, they tend to become the swim coach, the school teacher, the tutor, the priest, the counselor, so that they have access to kids.
And she talked about campaigning to change individual state laws around abuse.
There are states where if you were to sexually abuse the child next door, you might get 20 years or more. But if it's your own child and you have the lawyer, he could say, oh, no, no, you see, under this section of the law, he doesn't have to go to prison. He's eligible for probation, no time served, and even what they call deferred entry of judgment. So no sex offender list, no record.
Good Lord.
To turn around and open a school the next day.
And that's part of your desire to change law-wise.
Absolutely. And then, you know, you have the statute of limitations laws where, I mean, some of them were so bad, it was almost as if, you know, if you didn't report by the time you were 17 or something, it's like, good heavens, these people were abused when they're small children. Are they supposed to turn around at 9 and call the cops? I mean, how do they know? Yeah. So giving people more time to report, and then absolutely this whole syndrome where most of the time it's going to be someone you know.
Actor and campaigner Alison Arngrim with Ryan Tuberty on Thursday, and the full interview is well worth a listen. Now, there was a lot in the news this week about species in decline and even outright extinction. And one species here under threat is the swift. But Oran O'Sullivan, coordinator of the Wicklow Swift Project, was on Moonigoes Wild to talk about installing nest boxes in public buildings to encourage breeding. And he explained how to tell a swift from its doppelganger, the swallow.
Swifts are all dark. I refer to them often in interviews as the Formula One of birds. You might drive an Opel Corsa. These things are Formula One. The wings are scythe-like in shape. They're really strong flyers, short tail, all dark. I mean, swallow is pale underneath, has tail streamers. House martin is white below and has the white rump. In terms of nesting, if a bird disappears into the eave of a house, if it's not a sparrow or a starling, it's a swift. House martins nest outside on the apex of your roof, maybe. It's a mud nest that's visible. Swallows nest inside, a similar kind of nest, but inside in a shed or a barn or a building on a plank. So there's that difference. Good starting point, because obviously when you look up into the sky at seeing flocks of swallows and swifts, they often mix around, but they're a larger bird too, all dark, and these, as I say, Formula One shape, really sharp-looking wings and a bullet-shaped body. And if you're lucky, I'd say in the evenings, you can hear them screaming. It's a nice kind of screaming. Somebody said, oh, don't please say they're screaming because people won't like that. It's a scream, if you can think of it, a child screaming when they see ice cream, as it's distinct from when they see the bogeyman. it's a pleasant scream. And it really is the sound of summer. If swallows are the sound of spring, I think swifts are the icon of summer for me, certainly.
Moonigoes Wild on the birds, and from the birds to the bees. Yes, that was clumsy, but we'll go with it. Brian O'Connell went to investigate the dating scene and brought us what might just be the most excruciating first date in history. Here's Ronan.
Yeah, I had an interesting pre-COVID date. I'd organised through one of the apps just to have a drink with a girl. Anyway, I called her a couple of days beforehand and I sort of said, look, I've got this bit of a head cold and there's all this stuff in the news, you know, if you want to cancel the date, that's not a bother. So I was in town at the time. I was walking around Grafton Street and everything was full, bars were full. She was like, no, sure, we'll meet for a drink. So anyway, we did meet for a drink, and it ended up being the longest first date I've ever had. We're just in town, had a bite to eat. I live beside town, so we just popped back to mine and had a drink here. The next day I woke up and I was feeling a little bit poorly, worse than I was beforehand. Now, I'd had this head cold for a couple of weeks and it was sort of going away. The girl I was out with was reading the news, and she was sort of saying, look, looks like there's going to be a lockdown here. What am I supposed to do? Now, she just moved to Dublin and her friend was a nurse. So she rang her friend and her friend said, well, look, I'm working in the hospitals. If you think someone you've been in contact with might have it, best not to come back here. So she ended up having to stay for a couple of days. Because I couldn't get the test, she had to stay 3 days in the house. There's something about being infected with a pandemic disease that just takes the romance out of things.
And now, bearing in mind this is an early morning show, what were the 3 days in the house like?
I was living with my flatmates, two Spanish guys, and we were sort of had to isolate in the room. So like we were just going to, just in my room. So it was intense. I mean, we got on well. She's like an absolutely lovely girl. We got on very well. But like, when you don't know someone and we had to self-isolate in a room just in case we had it, it was, yeah, intense was one word for it.
Are you still in touch?
The odd text every now and again, but I don't think we'll be doing the semi-long, semi-short distance relationship.
Ronan, courtesy of Brian O'Connell, with a pretty fantastic anecdote, which might just have made the whole thing worth it. Maybe. But one man smitten by love in lockdown was comedian Des Bishop, who's currently stateside and who got up in the middle of the night to talk to Miriam O'Callaghan on Sunday.
I've fallen in love with a woman during the pandemic too. So all in all, despite the fact that all these memes are like, I can't wait for 2020 to be over, like 2020 will be the year that changed my life.
Okay, Des, I need to ask you about that new love. Because I've been interviewing you for a number of years, always hoping you find the right person. So is this her?
Were you non-committed to which gender I like?
But I know you a long time.
I'm just kidding. I said I never date comedians, actually. But then during the pandemic, there was this comedian I follow. We did not know each other. We just followed each other on Instagram. And I noticed that she was isolating out, you know, near here. Not that close, but near enough. And just in a moment of just like, oh, I didn't know you were out here. Do you want to get a coffee? She said, yeah. And then boom, we clicked immediately. And it's quite an intense sort of falling in love period since.
So is this it, Des?
Well, you can never say, Miriam. All we have is today. Can't predict the future. But I have to say, I've never spoken. I don't really speak publicly about such matters. However, this has been quite the... It's been a more powerful sort of falling for somebody than I've ever experienced in my life. So I would be confident in saying that I will certainly make an effort that it is it, because it feels like it. It's the one.
And the woman in question is called Hannah. And Des thinks that in some weird way, stopping work and performing might have helped make him more open.
I've been doing comedy since 1997. You know, I've been like fight or flight. Every time I go to work since 1997, adrenaline, cortisol, like I think my body was like, wow, this is like a welcome break. You can hide from yourself through stand-up comedy. So I was forced to not hide from myself for an extended period of time. And I'm grateful for the experience, because actually it was good for just working through some stuff.
So in a sense, because you weren't hiding from yourself, did that enable you to be more open to this profound new love you have found? Do you think it would have happened if you were still chasing from comedy circuit to comedy circuit?
I mean, my assumption would be it made me more open, yeah. I mean, I would agree with you, I think. But, that, you know, this is just conjecture. I have no idea. But, you know, when you go through the things that I went through over the last year and a half and you come out the other side of that, I do think that you're more comfortable in yourself and also, like, more open to intimacy, more open to being vulnerable. And those things, I think, allow you to get closer to somebody, I think, you know, because, of course, this Hannah is her name. Like, of course, she's amazing. We clicked straight away. But I've met many amazing women in my life. And I think that this concept of the one, I don't really know if it's true or not, you know, the soulmate stuff. But I do think that, like, if you're open to whatever's happening, that's when you can really fall. So I do think I was more open as a result.
And just before we all go off to get fitted for a fascinator, he did throw this caveat in.
Hey, we'll keep it a day at a time, you know? I don't want to be on your show next year. You'll be like, so how's it going, Hannah? It's like, oh, that. Let me tell you about her. She let me down, man.
Oh, I hope not. Every digit crossed for you, sir. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
I'm in the mood for love, simply because you're near me. Funny, but when you're near me, I'm in the mood for love. Heaven is in your eyes, brighter than stars you're under. Oh, is it any wonder? I'm in the mood for love. Up to think of weather, easy to dream, I bet. People are hard to